In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
Presidential candidates are good at making promises for expanding the middle class. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, July 24th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, a Frontline special documents two American families who work incredibly hard for an economy that doesn't work for them. Then the Dakota Political Junkies bring context for the wild weeks in American politics we've endured. SDSU political scientists Lisa Hager and David Wilty discuss an assassination attempt and a new candidate for the incumbent party. We'll preview an upcoming cultural festival in Sioux Falls through the lens of fashion, plus new music for the naysayers who think music has lost its creative edge. Fresh Tracks is later in the hour. We are broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, it is an election year, and the state of the economy is top of mind for many voters. Both parties are making their cases to the American people that they are the right economic choice. A new PBS Frontline documentary explores the stories of two families who have heard this campaign promise again and again over the past six presidential administrations. Two American Families, 1991 to 2024, follows the Stanley family and the Newmans over 30 years, beginning in the 90s when the primary earners of both families lost their jobs. Tom Cachado is the producer and director of Two American Families, and Kathleen Hughes is producer, director, and writer of the documentary. They are both joining us now on Zoom. Tom, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori.
Kathleen, welcome as well.
Thanks.
We were just reading your bio on your website, and we kind of want to interview you. But I think that's maybe for another day, but you seem a lot more interesting than we are.
I was reading your bios, and I was like, boy, we could talk about a lot more than two American families, but there's so much we could. So it's a mutual admiration society. Thank you for that. And Tom, why not start there? Because when I was watching this, I was struck by what a piece of journalism this is. And I want to talk about the families, of course, because our listeners really care about that. But sociology, journalism, the intersection between documentary film and an intimate interview, the presence of Bill Moyers, who has meant so much to many journalists, but really the relationships that you have with these people over the years. A project that follows people from 1991 to 2024. Tom, tell me a little bit about how broadly you think about that project and what it can mean for how we tell stories about our lives.
Well, when Kathy and I first met each other, which was in 1990, one of the first things we did was we went to see Michael Apted's film 28 Up, which was part of his 7 Up series, which I'm sure some of your listeners will be familiar with. He went to these 7-year-olds in Great Britain and did a whole film about them and then went back every 7 years. The first one was called 7 Up, and then it was 14 Up, 21 Up, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And we said, gee, we'd like to do something like that someday. Never in a million years expecting that we would. And in fact, when we started this project, it was a one-off. We made a single film. And each time we went back, and the Two American Families, 1991 to 2024, is the fifth in the series. Each time we went back, it was an experience that we had not necessarily been expecting to do.
Exactly. And when we started, we were going to find out what was happening to all these people being laid off, all these factory workers across the country, but especially in what we now call the Rust Belt. What was going to be next for them? And, there'd been a lot of different kinds of thought about what it could be. There were some people speculating that perhaps people would only work part-time and that technology would allow people to get involved civically. There were all these theories. And, we finally got this one guy on the phone who was called Robert Reich. He was a professor at Harvard, and he eventually became Bill Clinton's labor secretary.
Yeah.
But he said to us, you know, I've just been studying this, and the way I see it is that as a country, we're really starting to divide into two classes. We have a group of people who are very well off, and then people who are not going to be doing as well, and we're just hollowing out our middle. And we really, you know, that was what we were thinking about when we went out there. Go ahead, Tom.
I went to Milwaukee, and Kathy set me up with a meeting with some 80 laid off workers from the Briggs & Stratton Corporation, which if anybody out there has ever mowed a lawn, they probably know the name Briggs & Stratton, the engine maker. And I met with them in groups of 20, and I just said, if you were going to turn on the TV tonight and see something about your own experience, what would you want to see? Which is a great way to start a conversation with people. And that's when I met Tony Newman and Jackie Stanley, who were among those 80 people. And I followed up with them. They invited me to their homes. I met their spouses. I met their kids. Again, not knowing that we were going to continue. But even from the very beginning, Lori, I think the only word you can use here is privilege. It was a privilege to get to know these people and have them be willing to share their stories with us. Mm-hmm. And then as filmmakers, it's been a privilege to continue knowing them, but also to be able to make a film that goes in this deep with people. When we know them and they know us, they know what we do. And they, I guess, like what we do enough to keep saying yes when we ask to come around to them. Yeah. And any journalist or any filmmaker will tell you that the stronger the relationship, the more you're going to get the truest information. So for us, it's been a privilege and great fortune and a bit of good luck, too.
Mm, okay. Absolutely. And I think the families by now, they feel like they're willing to open their lives because they know that their stories are not exactly replicated around the country, but enough people have said to them, you know, I see some of my story in your story, and thank you for sharing your story. It makes me feel better. It's enlightening. So I think they've committed to doing this for those reasons too.
Yeah. I was going to say that, you know, personally, as I watched this, there were so many moments as I grew up in a working class family where I went, yep, I absolutely recognize that. And there's a part jumping ahead a bit in the documentary where one of the Stanley children is trying to get through college, and he's putting part of that tuition on his credit card. And they're figuring out this early use of a credit card to pay tuition. And like, I just got this pit in my stomach because I remember doing that. And I was on the GI Bill, but it was like $400 a month that they paid you. And that's what was paying my rent at the time. So then my tuition was just this, what an enormous gamble I am taking on this college degree. These people are working so incredibly hard, but they're also taking huge chances in entrepreneurship, in trying to get through college and using credit cards to do so, in searching for a new job after job loss, after job loss, after the constant retraining in a new technical field. It's astonishing and really familiar to watch. So for people who haven't seen this yet, and it's available on the PBS app now and online on Frontline. But these are working class people who work incredibly hard. And we are told in America, if we work really, really hard and if we have these really great attitudes, which, I mean, especially the Stanleys, I couldn't have that good of an attitude on a Tuesday morning, much less when they're going through some of these hard times. We are told we will get ahead. We will be better off than our parents. And for them, that is just not the case. Tell me a little bit about their journey, and whichever one of you wants to kick us off, go right ahead, please.
Well, long term, I think that you talked about how unusual it is to be able to watch these folks long term. And I think it's eye-opening because so often in our media environment, we talk about jobs in little chunks, and they'll say, you know, the headline will be more jobs were created this year than last year. And so often you don't get the context. Well, what kind of jobs are created? How much are those jobs paying? Do they offer benefits? Are they part-time or full-time? And that's, you know, I think when you spend time with these folks, you see that there, you know, so much of the economy is now based on low wages. Yeah. And so that their journey has been just trying to figure out where they fit into all of that. And they've done everything that has been advised. Like you said, there was lots of tax dollars put into retraining factory workers in the 1990s with promises that, you know, the ship would be righted. But so many of those jobs, even if they did ultimately pay a little bit more than minimum wage, went away too. So it's been a real cycle. Go ahead, Tom.
And for the Stanleys who've reached their 70s and the Newmans who are in their 60s, when they were laid off, they never got the years back, the 30 some years when they weren't earning wages that would put them in the middle class, would have put them in the middle class. Indeed, the kind of wages they thought were going to keep them in the middle class when they got these well-paying union jobs in the 1980s. And I think, you know, we can't write the future for their children, but we can say that they are part of economically a lost generation as far as achieving the American dream. Doesn't mean they don't have good lives in other ways. If you watch the film, you'll find there's a lot of love, there's friendship, parent to children, husband to wife. You know, it's they're not the most oppressed people in the world. They're just people who the country originally, I think, made a promise to, and the promise was never kept.
Yeah. How important are the idea of benefits? They're struggling again and again. I have this job, but there's no benefits. I have this job, but I have to work overnight to get a dollar extra per hour. And by the way, that puts me up to like $7, you know, dollars an hour, $8 an hour, $9 an hour. But right. The struggle to find a company who will pay sick time, who will give you vacation time, it's so elusive.
Exactly. Yes. And in both families, you over the years, we witness that one healthcare crisis that throws them into debt. Mm-hmm. Claude Stanley working in basements with gravel and eventually and all the stuff that comes into the air and eventually got a terrible lung disease and
lung infection.
Yes. And it put him in the hospital for a couple of weeks, put the family in about $30,000 in debt. And, you know, even when he was in the hospital, he wasn't getting they weren't paying him a salary because you only get paid for the hours you put in. So it's the system can be brutal at times.
So much also impacts their children. You can see, and I think the filmmaking is just incredibly respectful to the children. It takes their point of view, the times when they're afraid, the times when they're inspired, the times when they don't want to be like mom and dad. And yes. One of the children at once, like, I don't want to do some of those things. And I'm thinking, well, what? They did everything right. What do you not want to do? And he says, I don't want to have kids yet. I don't want to have to support a family. So what are some of the ways in 2024 that you were seeing this journey of the parents show up in the decision-making of their adult children?
You know, I think the biggest way is something you've already touched on, Lori, is that the kids and the younger generation are just working their tails off. The one lesson they did take from their parents, including whatever negative lessons they took about not wanting to be poor or not wanting to be struggling, if not poor, they learned that you have to go to work, you have to get a job. And if you do have to work that night shift to earn the extra dollar or two an hour, it's worth it to you. And if you do have to make other sacrifices in other areas of your life, it's worth it to you. And I think they represent so many Americans who have made these similar kind of choices and are continuing to make it, while at the same time, the film is very personal. And these folks, the Newmans and the Stanleys, they are not symbols. They're real people going through real things that a lot of other people can relate to. So I think hard work is the biggest lesson. I think an equal lesson to that is one that Keith Stanley, the oldest son in the African-American family, says in the film, is that hard work alone is not going to do it for you in this country. He knows that it's also who you're born to, how much money your parents make, what kind of education is afforded to you, that there are a lot of other things. And he says he's known a lot of very hardworking people who have not made it because they didn't have other advantages. So I think those are kind of twin lessons you can take away from the film.
Yeah,
absolutely. But I think that, you know, as a general observation, Americans, no matter where they're from and what their political belief system is, Americans work really hard.
Yeah.
I think that's, you can say that about people. It's our folks have never stopped working.
Yeah. They work very, very hard, and they believe in themselves, and they believe in their ability to go out and do the next thing. At the in their 70s, there's a I cried. Jackie Stanley is emotional in the thing, and she's like, "I'm Jackie Stanley. You know, I don't ask for help. I give it." You know, and after all of this, and basically, they're just talking about maybe not being able to, you know, take care of their community as much as. You know, she's not asking for a handout. She's maybe going to be giving a little bit less in her 70s. And that is an affront to her identity in some ways because they are such hardworking Americans. So validating for everybody who comes from working class families. And I think really eye-opening for people who don't to look and say, mm-hmm. This is maybe what, you know, dinner looks like, what a living room looks like, what a marriage looks like in some of these families that are still struggling to make it today. If we didn't learn that in the pandemic of who we thought was essential, we weren't paying very much attention. So we're going to leave it there for now, but please direct everyone to Frontlines to American Families 1991 to 2024. It's available to stream on YouTube, on Frontlines website, in the PBS app. You can go to sdpb.org and find it as well, all kinds of places to watch this two-hour special. Kathy and Tom, thank you so much for being here. Just, I'm a huge fan of your work.
Thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. It has been a busy week in political news. We once again turn to our Dakota political junkies to bring context to an unprecedented week or so. David Wiltse and Lisa Hager are both associate professors of political science at South Dakota State University, and they are seated in the SDPB Janine Basinger studio at SDSU. Now, Dr. Wiltse, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
Dr. Hager, welcome as well.
Great to be here as always.
All right, so I'm in the airport. And I look up as I walk by one of the airport's bars and I see this Trump rally and this footage playing the campaign rally, and I see this footage of the assassination attempt. And so then I go and I look and I, you know, I see what happened, and then I'm back to being fascinated about the fact that nobody is gathered around the television to look at this, and this seems like pretty monumental news to me. And so I'm like, well, people are looking at it on their phones like I am. So I start looking over people's shoulders and kind of spying on them to see who's watching this on the phone, who's talking about it. And literally no one in the airport was paying attention to this news as it unfolded. I can't explain that. I don't know what was happening.
No.
This is before the ground stoppage. I have no grander context for that. However, that brings me to the fact that this is not the first time violence has interrupted an American presidential campaign. It's not totally unprecedented. However, it is extraordinarily rare. So, Dave Wiltse, let's talk about the assassination attempt first. And there's lots that we still don't know about motive. Put it in context for us. How significant is this to have it happen during a campaign?
The last time I can think of when someone did this during a campaign was when Teddy Roosevelt was running in the Bull Moose Party. I think that's the last time. But, you know, in the grand scheme of things, assassination attempts on major political figures and violence towards political figures is unfortunately persistent. Not terribly common, but persistent enough that, you know, you can almost safely say that it is a part of the American political landscape. It's unfortunate. To me, this was shocking. I was not in a public place when this happened like you were, but I remember when I was a little kid, when Reagan was shot, we were in a mall in, I think, Fargo, and the place just stopped. and they were huddling around whatever radio or TV they could find. And I think your little vignette kind of speaks to the fact that it's shocking but not terribly unexpected. Mm. And that, yeah, that says some things about our political system and where we've come over the past past few decades.
Yeah. Okay, so
none of which is good, obviously.
Bobby Kennedy is killed in 1968, of course, when he's running for office.
Sorry.
And Ellen Kester, our producer, went and found found fact because I did not remember. And then 1972, George Wallace was campaigning to become the Democratic nominee and was shot and was paralyzed. He survived.
Yep.
So Donald Trump is largely uninjured. He has an injury to his ear, but he's not killed like Bobby Kennedy was. It is pretty shocking. Lisa, what would you add to this about how the introduction of political violence can change the campaign itself, the tone of it, the fervor of it?
I would say that it definitely did change the tone of the campaign because all of a sudden we are talking more about political violence and what that means. But these past couple of weeks have just been unprecedented, like you said, where now we're focused on a candidate withdrawing, the sitting president withdrawing from the race. So I feel like at this point it's almost as if some of this is getting overshadowed with the way our current political environment is.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Dave, what were you going to add there?
Oh, nothing. Okay. We just haven't, one shocking event after another in such quick sequence that it's hard to get your bearings right now.
The warning to, cool down the rhetoric. Mm-hmm. And depending on, how you feel about this, what side of the political aisle you're on, you might have some strong opinions about this. But by and large, everybody's like, you really got to be careful of what you say. And Republicans have tweeted, if you're going to say this man is a threat to democracy, you're going to encourage some bad behavior from people who take that seriously. Now, we heard this during the George Floyd riots. We heard this on January 6th. We're hearing it again. How much does it matter what leaders say and how people interpret that? We live in a country protected by the First Amendment, but yet there are limitations to that.
What they say matters, but where you really need to parse it out is where is it that they're saying things that might be inflammatory, but also where are they saying things that are directly inciting this kind of stuff? I don't think you can credibly accuse anyone on the political left of directly inciting this kind of violence directed at President Trump. I just don't see it. Whereas, on January 6th, you saw a lot of rhetoric coming out of the political right that was pushing people towards exactly what happened with the Capitol takeover. So this was, really overplayed, I think, on the Trump camp here. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of this stuff was just quickly dismissed and forgotten, certainly after Biden dropped out of the race.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit, because there had been, after the debate, where President Biden showed up not well. They said he was ill, he had a cold, a lot of criticism was coming at him from his own party about his mental fitness to run a campaign. And finally, after saying he was going to stay in, he was the candidate, I'm not going to give up now, he did in fact step aside. Lisa, constitutionally now, he has a whole bunch of delegates. What happens next?
So the biggest thing is that with the nomination, the parties are controlling that particular process. And so we can get into that if we want to here. But the constitutional question at stake is, is he unfit to run or is he unfit to continue to serve? Because then constitutionally, there is something to do with the fact that he is unfit to serve. And so then you have the 25th Amendment coming into play where there is a procedure by which President Biden could, in fact, be removed from office.
Mm-hmm. And you've seen Vance kind of play up on this in a few of his speeches and a few of his tweets. Mm-hmm. But again, that's pretty thin ground. Constitutionally, the Constitution really doesn't impact this at all. This yeah. is a party matter, and the party's going to settle it.
We were talking about the 25th Amendment during the waning days of the President Trump administration, too, where people were saying he was unfit to serve. So the 25th Amendment is talked about, but we haven't seen anything much come of it. Do you anticipate anything will come of that between now and January, that or now in November, where there will be a serious challenge to Biden's fitness to be president?
I don't think so at this point, especially since the 25th Amendment procedure involves the vice president, and I don't think that that's in the best interest of current Vice President Harris.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about Vice President Harris. President Biden has thrown his support behind her. What do we know about, you know, fundraising? Does she, you know, she's on the ticket. Does she have access to campaign donations? Does she have to start afresh? What's the path ahead for her to shore up the support of delegates before a convention, not to mention American voters?
Well, the good thing as far as the delegates go is you don't need to spend a lot of money to shore up the delegates for the convention. In fact, they've pretty much done it by all the reports. That really comes from direct lobbying, direct politicking that's been going on since a couple days before Biden announced. As far as the committee monies go, that is a somewhat open question. It's not a perfect transition. It's not as if Biden can just sign over all that money from the various committees to the Harris campaign, but some of it can, especially some of the soft money and the party money that can be very easily transitioned. But she is, she's gone on a fundraising bonanza over the last few days. All signs are pointing to her not worrying about resources in the end. I think the Democratic base will be sufficiently energized to really infuse her campaign with the resources she needs.
Yeah. All right, so what does she have to do? Women's path to power. Lisa Hager, this has to be an unusual path to power for Kamala Harris as a female leader, or not. Can you tell us?
I mean, it's not, super common necessarily, but when Evren and I wrote our book, one of the things that we noticed is that women in presidential systems do struggle to find themselves in that top seat because of the fact that they're dealing with getting the voters to vote for them. So that's drastically different than when you can, basically be put into a particular executive position, like prime minister, for instance. Mm-hmm. And so, she does have an uphill battle. I would say the fact that she's coming through that political career path is useful for her. So she has specific things that she can point to as areas of success, and that, I've climbed that political ladder, so to speak. That will be helpful for her. So, the one thing that we do kind of find is that women in legislatures or with legislative experience don't always do as well as those who have cabinet experience of some kind. So I think kind of seeing how this plays out with her and being the vice president will be kind of interesting, because that will be different than, she has legislative experience, but how does that play in with that and not having that cabinet experience?
Right. All right. So a couple weeks ago, maybe even last week, we were saying, a lot of people wanted this election to give us something new, give us something different. We don't want this whole thing litigated again. Well, guess what? Did this just get interesting, Dave? Did the November election get more interesting?
It got a lot more interesting. It's going to get more litigious. I expect lawsuits on every single campaign committee that has any resources to dole out. There are going to be questions about the legitimacy of the path that Harris has taken. But let's just say unequivocally, before 1968, this is exactly how you would have become president. Or before 1972, this is exactly how you'd get the nominee. And in most democracies, this is how you get the nominations to office. But yeah, it was a political earthquake.
Yeah.
Between the two events, particularly Biden dropping out at this late of a date. We've not seen that. I mean, Lyndon Johnson dropped out on March 31st of 1968, and people thought that was an atom bomb in the nomination. This is just a total political earthquake.
What does she have to do? Does she have to turn her attention to the legal battles, or does she need to stay clear of that and let other people fight it and just get out in front of the American people and introduce herself? Because I think some of the recent polling has said people are undecided. And when I saw those polls, I was like, well, of course, you know, you would be undecided the 2 days after the announcement is made. But what does she have to do to move people to her side and be decided? And likewise, what do the Republicans have to do to take advantage of the fact that this change maybe works for them? Maybe it works against them. I just don't know. But what happens
it
next?
It really cuts both ways.
Yeah.
It really cuts both ways because in so many ways, in some ways you can say this is an advantage to Biden or to the Democrats because it erases all those personal issues that Biden had. He had a lot of high negatives. He didn't have, doesn't have a very good popularity rating right now, approval rating right now. Mm-hmm. Things just dragging him down, wasn't doing very well with younger voters. All that's erased. And there were a lot of Democrats across the country that were running higher than he was in terms of the tracking polls. So that's good for the Democrats' prospects. What's bad is the organizational side of things. Mm-hmm. We have very weak parties. They are not very well structured. They are very personalized by the presidential candidates. So the downside here is organizational. The downside is resources. Not all of those resources, not all those organizational structures are just going to smoothly transfer to Harris. So in that way, this could be challenging for the Democrats.
Yeah. Huge advantage for the Republicans. Yeah. That's what they need to leave. They just have a candidate who survived, who dodged a bullet. That's hard to beat in the popular lore as well. It makes him look stronger. And they're leaning into that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well,
But that was all against Biden's weakness. So that's kind of washed away now.
Right. The timing. That goes back to what you said about the timing.
Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, more later. Lisa Hager, Dave Wiltsie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. This Friday and Saturday, Leavitt at the Falls hosts the All My Relatives Festival. The celebration will honor and showcase Indigenous culture, including fashion. The Indigenous Fashion Show features Native designers and designs at 2 p.m. on Saturday. Joining us now from SDPB's Vermilion Studio on the campus of USD is Kyrie Dunkley. Kyrie is owner and designer of Shining Star Style. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for the invitation again.
Tell us a little bit about last year's show and some of that experience that you brought into preparation for this year's designs and this year's show.
Okay, last year I believe we had about 22 models that came to the show and 3 designers total. And we showcased the fashion show backstage of the Leavitt. And this year we have 6 total designers that applied and were scheduled to be in the show. As of now, we have about 5. And 53 model applicants, 49 mm-hmm. have confirmed that they will be in the show.
That's fantastic. All right, as you prepare your designs for the runway, tell me what themes are sparking your interest, what motifs, what stories. Help us get an idea of what we're going to see.
Last year, my designs were based off of the 49 design fabric that came from Canada, and it was Indigenous sourced. This year, I have created my own ready-to-wear collection, and it's my first one that I launched on Shopify earlier this year. And those designs are graphic designs that I previously used as applique designs on my ribbon skirts. Mm-hmm. That is something that I started off doing. That's where my business launched from, was from ribbon skirts and applique work. So I turned applique designs into graphics. So you will see horse designs, star designs, and the color sequences that I'm using on my ready-to-wear collection is a reflection of the Northern Lights. Yeah. My business started after the passing of my late husband, Matthew Dunkley Sr., and that was in 2018 of May. And something that's been tying everything in since then has been him. It's been a central focal point. My life changed after him. My life changed when I had my son, and all of the passions that I'm pursuing started around that time frame. And when he passed away, it was per suicide. And the Great Plains Tribal Health Leader Board stepped in and decided to sponsor a large portion of this fashion show with that message. And it wasn't something I ever told them, but I really appreciate that they are supporting the show in that way. And so the Ready to Wear collection that I have is in remembrance of him. I just wanted to remember him. I had no idea that we were going to reschedule the dates for the festival to where it is now. His birthday is Friday.
Oh, wow.
So it's just really special that it all tied in that way without, you know, actually planning it that way.
Yeah. Wow. And that just, that means so much. And I think for anybody who's watching those models walk or the models themselves, when they know that, it says, what a great example of how fashion can say so much at the same time. Tell us in our closing moments here, you know, why fashion for you? Why sewing? Why design? Why Ready to Wear collection? Why is this the thing that you're drawn to? And we really have like 30 seconds, but briefly, if you had to explain to an investor or somebody, you know, why this matters so much to you, the fashion world.
Self-expression is my identity. It represents my culture, my family. And I'm currently at a Messy Hands camp here in Vermilion, and that's the reason why I'm here, is to teach that to the children too. Having that strong identity and background gives you so much confidence, and not just in modeling, but in your life's journey. It could take you in so many different directions.
Mm. All right, so if you wanna look her up, Shining Star Style, we'll put some links up on our website so you can find Kyrie Dunkley and also attend the All My Relatives event at Love It at the Falls. That is in Sioux Falls this Friday and Saturday. SDPB streams those, by the way. So if you're not in the area, you can find things online. That fashion show scheduled for 2 p.m. on Saturday. There is a meet and greet and designer sales at 4 p.m. Kyrie Dunkley, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
It's been quite a week in political headlines, but what about the controversy of music journalism headlines? For this installment of Fresh Tracks, David Herserud takes on music writers who disparage today's artists and new releases. Let's get beyond those headlines to discover some great new music for the good old days we're living through right now.
Hello.
Hello.
Is that you?
Baby,
this is you know who.
Hello,
hello, is that you?
Uh-huh.
I'm calling like I said I do. Told me when I called you, keep my voice down low.
Well, and in some cases, I'm not sure is what is worse these days. Articles that you see in publications about politics or music. For example, there was a latest music headline, "It All Sounds the Same." I think you could apply that to probably both of them. Some other headlines that I've come across, song lyrics are repetitive. Albums are longer, songs are getting shorter. Where is the creativity today? They don't make music like they used to. I mean, if you wish for the good old days, we have some modern music suggestions for you. And we're going to kick it off with Wiley Bigger. I think that this is his first full-length album called Broken Telephone. He's a 20-something musician who grew up on the front porch of Memphis, Tennessee. He was fortunate growing up that he was able to see Jerry Lee Lewis and B.B. King in concert at a very young age. he started playing piano at age 4 and developed very early on a passion for Delta blues and rock and roll. In fact, he was able to do some recording at the legendary Sun Studios in Memphis. His debut album, Broken Telephone, is just out. I really, really, really enjoyed it. His first video is a remake of a 1957 song by the Mississippi dance band, the Red Tops. And it's from an old 45 that he found in his grandfather's record collection. Baby, this is you know. By the way, in case the name rings a bell, his sister Bailey is a country folk artist whose debut album, Coyote Red, came out a couple of years ago and has gotten tremendous reviews. I mean, talk about a musical family.
All right, let's switch to Pedal Steel Noah, a prodigy in the making.
He has come out with his first album, which is an EP called Texas Madness. And Noah is a teenager and somehow got interested in the pedal steel guitar, which is an incredibly difficult instrument to play because you're using both hands, you're using your feet and your knees. And he started recording videos often on a daily basis and put them up on Instagram and TikTok. And they were covers of new wave and post-punk hit songs that his mother recommended that he play. So, and all of a sudden, these music videos just became huge. He's kind of in the front playing the pedal steel guitar. In the back is his brother, barefoot, playing the bass guitar, and in front is the family's Aussie Doodle dog panting. They've got a bunch of videos up on YouTube. Yeah. The music he's playing, okay, is everything from Judas Priest to My Bloody Valentine to Tears for Fears, The Cure. And one of the interesting things this year when we were at South by Southwest is Noah did a number of showcases and they were just jam-packed, which I thought was absolutely wonderful. Texas Madness came out on April 1st and Noah wanted it done on that particular date because that was the beginning of Autism Acceptance Month. One of my favorite classic songs is Joy Division's Love Will Tear Us Apart.
We are going to return to the Kitchen Dwellers, which you introduced us to not too long ago. We're back talking about this Bozeman, Montana quartet.
Yeah, they just come out with their fourth album called Seven Devils, which is inspired, believe it or not, by Dante's Inferno. They play bluegrass, but they call it galaxy grass, which is bluegrass with kind of a rock and roll energy and just a hint of psychedelica. They're not exactly your grandfather's bluegrass, and they don't want to be. And as you mentioned, we played a live version of them doing Tommy Two Tone's classic 867-5309, Jenny Jenny, you know, a couple of months ago. They're a phenomenal band, incredibly, incredibly talented. You can't, it's like Steve Martin used to talk about people playing the banjo. It just makes you feel happy, makes you feel good. And I think kind of bluegrass is the same thing, but the Kitchen Dwellers are a superb band.
Leaving this morning out of Oakland to the prairie. Last night I might have got some rest. Hard way to fall from a heartbreak to a city. But year after year I chase my troubles here. You can't steal a heart if you know you never found it.
All right, we've got time for one more, and it is Andrew Bird. Tell us about this artist.
Well, the album is called Sunday Morning Put On, and I've been a big fan of Andrew Bird. He produces albums at an incredible rate. He's classified as an indie rock multi-instrumentalist singer and songwriter. But his musical tastes are so wide-ranging that trying to categorize him becomes very, very difficult. His latest album is proof enough of that. It's an album of jazz standards from people like Duke Ellington, Cole Porter, and classic songs like I Cover the Waterfront.
With the one I love be coming back to me. And I cover the waterfront in search of my
love. In his 20s, he lived in Chicago, and there was a wonderful station there, WBEZ, which was one of the first charter members of NPR in 1970, and they played a ton of jazz music, particularly at night. And I have to tell you, we were living in Chicago at the time, and WBEZ was one of my favorite stations. This album is completely different from anything Andrew has done. But if you take a look at the songs, the albums that he's recorded over the years, you shouldn't be surprised.
Return, oh, I cover the waterfront. And I'm watching the sea.
So are we living in the current good old days that someday people will look back on?
That becomes the big question. I'm not sure how many people, you know, 20 years from now are going to be listening to Drake. I'm assuming that they probably will, but, you know, who knows?
Baby, this is you know.
You can find all our music coverage, including Fresh Tracks, which has links to the music you just heard, on our website, sdpb.org/music. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you on Tomorrow's In the Moment. It is a music festival with no main stage. Bring your lawn chair, bring your guitar, sit in on a song circle. We will preview the Montrose Music Festival and talk about what it means for music and community to support rural South Dakota. Plus, we've got a new installment of Summer with the Symphony. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. We thank you for listening.